government debt has a negative multiplier. That means it's unproductive debt, that the benefit you get from that debt, there is a benefit initially, the money gets spent, it boosts the economy, ultimately hampers economic activity more than it helps it. So that hampering part from 2021, 22, 23 is that's in our future. There's more of a headwind from that old debt that's coming down the pike. So can the government continue to just boost fiscal spending more and more? Maybe, but they're not going to be able to do it at 4 or 5% interest rates. They're going to need the Fed to help them out. They're going to need much lower interest rates to keep kind of to keep the Ponzi scheme going.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Inflation for January rose higher than expected. Is this a one-off blip, or is it a sign that the remaining inflation in the system is sticky and going to prove harder for the Federal Reserve to get under control? Some analysts have been warning that we may be falling into the same trap as we did in the 1970s, which saw a series of roller coaster surges and drops in inflation until Fed Chair Paul Volcker was forced to rise interest rates up to a crippling 20% to get prices under control. Is that kind of pain possibly in our future? To find out, we're fortunate to hear today from Michael Leibowitz, portfolio manager at Real Investment Advice. He works closely with Lance Roberts, who regular viewers see on this channel with me every Saturday. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here again.
All right. Well, Michael, look, always great talking with you. Thanks so much for coming on. We are going to talk bonds a little bit, but I really want to spend a lot of time talking about inflation because you wrote a pretty detailed series on this exact topic. Very quickly for folks, I just want to give a quick note that you are going to be participating in the upcoming Thoughtful Money Conference in 31 days from now on Saturday, March 16th. You're going to go really deep into bonds there. So we're going to have sort of a high level conversation on bonds here in this discussion, but then we're going to go really deep into your forecasts at the conference itself.
Sounds good.
All right. So to kick things off here, let's start with a question I love to ask you every time you come on at the beginning. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
So it's interesting you're asking me that because we just found out Japan and the UK just slipped into a recession, two consecutive quarters of negative growth. Germany slipped into a recession when they reported their GDP, I think it was a couple, 2-3 weeks ago. So who are the top six nations based on economy? Well, US is far and away number one, then comes China, and then it's those three countries I mentioned, UK, Germany, Japan, and India. Growth is stagnating. Their growth rate is still decently high. So for them, going into a recession would be pretty hard, but getting down to something like 2-4% growth is sort of recessionary for them, right? So what's left is India, and we can leave that we can deal with that one another day. But basically the major economic powers, except for the US, are in a recession. So it's interesting. You look at like the small business surveys, they're telling you it's a recession. You look at regional manufacturing surveys, they've been in a recession for well over a year now. So there's, you know, if this is the data you had, I'd be telling you we're in a recession or we're going to be entering one very, very soon. But you look at the data and it's not recessionary at all. It's a very robust economy. Employment's at near a 50-year low. Some sectors are doing decently well. So, you know, I think we are still coming in for a landing. I don't think this Goldilocks notion will come to fruition. The question in my mind is how hard or soft is the landing? And I think a lot of that just depends on it. A lot of it is just consumer behavior, psychology, and a lot of it is kind of the Fed's reaction function. And of course, how the government reacts via stimulus.
All right. Well, Michael, as they say, collapse happens from the periphery in, where it's the weaker players that fall first, and then you progressively have bigger and bigger players fail as you get into the biggest one, in this case, US being the biggest one. We're at the part in the story where it sounds like a number of the big players in our peer set are beginning to be forced to their knees in terms of having some sort of landing. You just mentioned the three countries that are now in recession, at least technical recession. We're going to find out how hard their landings are, I think, over the next couple of quarters. Obviously, the big question that's being raised is, will the U.S. buck that trend, or are these dominoes that are falling and they're going to topple us eventually too? I think the data is mixed, although the headline data right now has been relatively strong, although we're going to dig into some of the more recent inflation stuff in just a second. It's interesting because we've had the emergence of this new no landing or butterfly soft landing, emerge. So obviously, if we're due for anything worse than that, that's going to be a surprise to Wall Street. You did, though, mention the Fed's reaction function and the fact that it's an election year. And I think there's a confidence out there that no matter what looks like might want to happen this year, the central planners are just standing at the ready with whatever it's going to take to keep things going, keep the airplane, in the air, preventing it from having to land, at least until the November presidential elections ahead of us. Time will tell on that, I guess. So good question answering my point about where the global economy is, but how about the financial markets? How are they striking you given this economic situation you just laid out?
They're reacting to Goldilocks. I mean, right now you got a government that is spending a ton of money in a very good economy. Typically, the government spends less money in a good economy, more money stimulus in a bad economy. They're doing what they shouldn't really be doing. They're boosting an already decent economy. The Fed has taken liquidity out of the markets to some degree. They're certainly keeping rates restrictive to a lot of borrowers. So, the U.S. Shoot, I'm sorry. Can we start that over?
Yeah, sure.
I completely forgot your question.
Oh, just the markets. And you started with a great answer, which is their price for Goldilocks. But yeah.
Okay, so the question was, how are markets reacting? Okay.
Well, just your thoughts on the financial markets, but certainly in regards to the economic situation you just laid out.
Right. So the markets are kind of taking its cue from Goldilocks, from this beautiful, wonderful, perfect landing by Jerome Powell. Can that happen? Anything's possible. But I think the markets are really basing themselves off of the Fed. They've seen high rates now for a while. It hasn't really affected the economy, although I think it will. I still think the lag effect will hold true. It's just taking a lot longer because of all the stimulus. But I think at the end of the day, right now, what's there not to like as an investor? The government is pumping money into the economy. Their deficit is extremely high for a robust economy. We've never really seen anything like this. Spending like this when the economy is in such good shape. Typically, we see spending like this when the economy when we're in a recession,
Or a world war.
or a world war. So you have that big tailwind helping us out here. So I think the markets are kind of primed for Goldilocks, and then on the horizon, they see the Fed's going to be cutting rates. Now it's wavering back and forth whether they cut in June or March and or the end of the year, but I think they see that as a positive that the Fed's cutting rates. But and this is kind of the distinction, I think, this is the market's mind. The Fed is going to cut rates in a nice environment. Typically, the Fed cuts rates because the economy's slowing quickly, there's a banking crisis, there's something going on, and the Fed's reacting. They're cutting rates to react to something. This time, I think the market thinks the Fed is just going to be doing it because they were too high for too long, and they're going to bring them back to a rate that's more commensurate with inflation, with kind of more traditional levels. And that, in the market's mind, is a good thing. You got the government pumping in money, you got the Fed that's going to be accommodative at some point, debatable when, but at some point. And look, even the Fed said they're going to lower rates two or three times this year. So the Fed's kind of acquiescing to that point of view as well. Everything looks perfect. What could possibly go wrong, Adam?
Well, inflation maybe could go wrong, and
Right.
we're going to talk about that in just a second. Yeah, and You talk about, well, you mentioned the lag effects, right? And that's another thing that could sort of spoil the party, right? Could the tide of rising liquidity that's been basically rising since what I think about October of 2022, right, when the market bottomed, is when the liquidity sort of turned around from net negative to net positive. Could that just continue being the only thing that really matters here up until the elections, or do things start getting away from the central planners, either because of the lag effects or because some of the contributors to that liquidity start getting pulled away, right? We have, we're not getting more fiscal stimulus passed through the system. We are doing a lot of deficit spending, but it's spending that was already pre-approved. The employee retention program, which was sort of an adjunct program to the PPP loans that were out there, that was rewarding employers for keeping people employed during the pandemic. Those funds have been turned off. We've got the reverse repo program looking like it's running dry. We have the expiration of the Bank Term Funding Program, and still QT going on through this until at such time the Fed stops doing that. You can make a good argument that there are, not black swans, but swans we can see circulating out there that could potentially ruin the party a little bit. Now, again, as we mentioned, it's an election year. Maybe they don't care and they're just going to do whatever it takes, like I said earlier. But it's not that there's nothing that could go wrong from here.
And there's another big problem that you didn't mention. Interest rates are still very high. Mortgage rates are around 7%. Treasury's borrowing at 4% on up. Car loans are 7, 8, 9%. Credit card debt is at whatever it is, 20 something percent. Corporations now have to pay a lot more for the money. Now, the reason that this is still a problem, you're going to say, well, it's been 3 years and it hasn't mattered. Why should it matter now? And the reason is because let's look at corporations. Large companies borrowed a ton of money when rates were really low, and they basically pushed out their borrowing needs. Those borrowing needs will come due at some point. People have delayed buying cars. At some point, they have to buy a car, and they're going to pay that high rate. Same with houses. The housing market has been frozen now for what, 2 years? Some point, people are going to want to sell, have to sell. People are tired of waiting to buy. So those lag effects from interest rates are a huge deal, and they have yet to truly affect larger companies and many consumers. But smaller companies are definitely feeling it.
A couple of things. One, on the day you and I are talking here, the January retail sales numbers just came out, and they were pretty horrible. I think it was the biggest year-on-year decline that we've seen since like early of 2020, which when we shut the global economy down, right? So it's a sign that's starting to show some cracks in the narrative we've had out here, right? Which is the economy strong and the consumer is strong, right? Well, the consumers are now starting to cut back on their spending. Regular viewers of this channel don't need to hear me, beat the drum of the lag effect because I do it so often here. But I'm concerned about exactly what you've raised here. And to the point about, the Fed cutting this year, all last year, the market just was expecting the Fed to pivot, every time the Fed met, right? And the Fed kept saying, nope, we're going to be higher for longer. We're super serious. We're not going to change policy until we get inflation down where we want it to get. And the market kept saying, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. And the market always had to adjust its expectations. It was the market that lost that game of chicken.
Right.
And what's so interesting is it didn't matter. Right. Stocks kept going up all last year. And again, I see that as probably mostly due to this rising tide of liquidity that then finally got animal spirits going, where they just said, hey, you know what? Forget the lag effect. It doesn't matter. Right. Now that the Fed has basically said, hey, we've stopped hiking, expect cuts from us next. The market has gone hog wild. Animal spirits have run amok. The stock market has melted up. And I think the market is still pricing in. It's had to bring it back down, I think, from seven, but I think the market's still pricing in like six rate cuts or something like that this year.
Five-ish, but yeah, it's still aggressive compared to what the Fed thinks.
Still much more than the Fed is guiding, right? But to your point, even if the Fed delivers on its three this year, which I think is is maybe getting cast into doubt a little bit now with this most recent inflation data we're about to talk about. Even if the Fed delivers 3 rate cuts, we're down to what at that point? 4.75? Let's be generous and say 4.5.
One and a half.
That's still way more than what the economy was used to paying before the rate hike kicked in, when all those larger companies raised financing, debt financing the last time.
Right.
So the point is those rate cuts aren't going to do all that much to ease the burden of this maturity wall that's coming up. And we've been talking about it for a long time, so it's been very academic to people. It's now actually starting to arrive. And in 2024, we'll have almost $1 trillion of corporate debt re-rate, and then more than that in 2025. So we're really beginning to enter that time phase yet. And what several guests I've had on the program have said is, you know, when that happens, right, the cost structure of the company goes up. So if it wants to try to preserve its profit margins, it has to start going to cost-cutting mode, right? And what these, you know, recent experts have been saying is, hey, companies don't wait until their debt rolls over to start making those cuts. The CFOs are smart. They can do basic math. So it's when they're about like 6 months out from having to go back out and refinance, that's when they start shedding costs in anticipation of the higher interest costs that they're going to have to spend. So I think that's why we're seeing so many more, at least so many more companies report that they plan to do layoffs this year. We've had a huge spike in companies saying that they plan to do layoffs. And we've had a huge spike in layoffs since the start of this year, right? We're actually beginning to see them delivering upon their plans. So until and unless at such time that interest rates, you know, magically come back down to the territory where they were before, or back when the companies took on debt prior, I need someone to tell me why we're not going to just see more of this play out in terms of companies laying off more and more people to try to preserve their profit margins.
Right. And I think one reason is why it has been so slow, and really the unemployment rate's about as low as it's been, is labor hoarding.
Right.
Companies are so scared that they can't hire someone if they need them, that they're just holding on to employees that end up costing them more money than they make off that employee. And that works for a while. When your earnings are doing well and you can report to shareholders that you're beating their estimates on both sales and earnings, and everything's going swimmingly, you can afford to kind of prop up some employees that you would typically let go because you don't know how you're going to replace them, you know, for the next cycle. But I think as time goes on, especially in smaller businesses, and it'll work its way up to larger businesses, they're realizing you can't hold on to employees that don't produce, whatever produce may mean for that company. And I think, you know, we talk about the Michael Kantrowitz's HOPE framework. It should be small hop, big E, because
Right.
this is all about the E. And as soon as employment starts to show signs of upticking, I think that's when we can start talking about recession potential. But, you know, there are signs that the market is normalizing. The number of job openings, job hires are really low. So people aren't hiring. They're just not firing. Initial jobless claims remain pretty low. Continuing claims aren't increasing at a great rate. They're still at a very low number as well. The BLS numbers are good. ADP number, a private sector number, is fine. It's not great, but they're still growing 100,000 a month. So there's nothing in the E that really alarms us. You know, you can talk to full-time versus part-time and hours worked, and this and that, and they're all potential warnings, but the canary hasn't crocked over. The E in the employment is still doing really well. And it's when people start getting laid off, is when behaviors change. And it's not necessarily when you lose your job, it's when your neighbor or your coworker lose their job and you're like, that could be me. I better spend less. Let's not go out to dinner tonight. Let's avoid the movie next Thursday night. Let's start to save some money. We don't need a new car this year. We can wait till next year. And that's kind of where my biggest focus is, on the labor data. And there's a lot of labor data. The big one is the BLS, but there's a lot. And when that starts turning, then we can start trying to figure out what type of landing this is going to be.
So I totally agree, and I'd say a lot on this channel, this regular view is here, that it is all about the E in the HOPE framework. It is all about employment. And as a reminder to folks, I'm planning on having Michael Kantorowicz back on soon. In fact, I'm trying to see if I can get maybe him and Eric Basmajian, because they both track a lot of employment data. It'd be great to get a discussion of the two of them to share, you know, what they're seeing in real time here, given the importance of this. I just want to underscore my belief here, or my understanding, and see if you share with it, with that this, you know, labor hoarding is, it's sort of one of these, the Hemingway quote about how we went bankrupt, right? Slowly and then all at once, right? It's one of these things that, because it's kind of a belief, right? You're saying, okay, look, it's gonna net benefit me to hold on to these employees, even if they're not super productive right now, because the economy cycle will pick back up at some point. I don't want to have the cost of having to go back and try to hire them again, and maybe I've lost a bunch of them to competitors, right? And that's what happened. Generals always fight the last war, right? That's what happened to everybody after COVID, right? Everybody shed a bunch of workers, and it was super hard to get them back again, right? So that's the wound in their mind that they still remember. But it's a belief that that hoarding is in their interest. Once they get to the point where that belief tips from, oh, this is positive for me, to this is actually a negative for me, then they start shedding, right? And they start shedding en masse, right? Because it begins to become a sort of an existential thing for them, especially if they start seeing others in their peer set, right, start struggling, where they're like, hey, that could be me. I got to take, you know, advance action to make sure that hopefully I don't have to experience what they're going through. So I just want to make sure that folks who hear us talk about this understand we're worried about it, because once it does happen, the bad tends to happen at a very rapid speed relative to the buildup.
Right. If you look at graphs of unemployment, it kind of turns slowly and then it shoots higher. And, you know, ha has that cycle been broken? Maybe every other cycle seems to have been broken, but I'm old school. I still think that when unemployment starts ticking up, it's going to start ticking up at a pretty decent rate.
Okay, we are going to get it in a bit to your market outlook, but kind of on this topic, just asking you to prognosticate here, given all the uncertainty here in 2024, are your expectations such that it's going to be a rockier road for all the reasons we're talking about than the market is currently expecting?
I think it will be economically or market-wise or both.
Both.
Yeah, I think it's generally going to be a rocky road for both markets and for the economy. I think the unemployment rate does start ticking up at some point. How much and how quickly, it's hard to tell. I mean, this economy has been strong and robust. And, you know, I've been very late. You know, I keep calling for a recession, it doesn't happen. So you got to give some benefit of the doubt to the economy and to the stimulus and to everything else that's propping up the economy. But also remember, we have an election, and it's not funny. The sad part of this election is that typically when you know who the two candidates are, those are the two candidates. There's no question in anyone's mind who those candidates are. Well, you know, come May, you know, you got Super Tuesday in March. Come May, Biden and Trump will have pretty much, they're the two candidates. I don't think anyone can tell you with 100% certainty that they're going to be the ones running in November. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty with, you know, ultimately who's running. What is Biden's a kind of a known commodity at this point. Trump is not a known, even though he was a president, he's not a known commodity. So I think there's going to be a lot of volatility, both economic, people saying, look, I don't know what's going to happen after this election. My guy's not going to win. That's not good for the economy. You know, we've seen these confidence polls. Democrats are a lot more confident than Republicans. That those may flip if it becomes obvious that Trump or some other Republican may win. So I think people will kind of say, you know what, let's just save a little bit of money here as we. Because we don't know who's going to win this election and what that means for the economy. And I think the market, same thing. Whenever you introduce unknowns, you create volatility. So as if we didn't have enough unknowns right now between, you know, kind of the Fed and then kind of geopolitical affairs, you're throwing a kind of a crazy election into the whole mix. And it's also the House and Senate could both flip or not flip. So it's not just the president, it's the whole makeup of Washington.
All right. Well, and as we know, markets hate uncertainty, right? So
Right.
if that uncertainty persists, then
Well,
markets should.
consumers don't like uncertainty either, so that's the point. And corporations don't. So it's not just the markets and the effect that has on consumers, but it's also the effect that it actually the uncertainty itself has on consumers.
Yeah.
So
And obviously, the more uncertain they feel, they probably tight rein in their purse strings.
exactly.
And then that impacts the economy because we're 70% consumer spending driven. So let me ask you this. So, yes, election year, as I've said several times, I think there's a lot of people out there that just say, look, don't worry. The powers that be will do whatever they can to keep things as stable as possible up until November. But you and I here we're still kind of debating whether the lag effect's going to arrive from things that happened a year and a half, 2 years ago, right? And they haven't arrived yet, right? And monetary policy in general acts with a lag that's measured in quarters, right? It's usually like somewhere between 9 to 16 months is when the lever gets pulled traditionally that you see it, out in the wild in the economy because it takes so long to express itself, which is why there's a lag, that term lag. So is there much like let's say that all of a sudden things start getting, rocky in a month or two and they want to keep things happy up until the election. Is there much they can actually do then that can prevent, natural forces from pushing things around before the election, or does not their reaction have a lag to it as well?
I think, and this is Bernanke's theory, that at the end of the day, if they cut rates, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to have a big effect. There is some effect, but there's a big lag effect to lower rates just as there are to higher rates. But I think it's in sentiment. So if let's say that the Fed starts to get concerned and they cut rates 50 basis points, 50 basis points again, they ultimately bring them down by 1.5%, stock market goes wild. That boosts confidence, and that can help offset whatever kind of weakness there is in the economy. So, yeah, I think that the Fed can potentially do that, assuming that they continue to unleash the animal spirits. But that's a big unknown. So,
So
you know.
let me pull on that thread with you just for a second. So let's say they do that, right? And I agree with you, they can push optics around, right? And the stock market reacts, at least portions of it react much more quickly to policy changes, expecting
Right.
that eventually it's going to be manifested in the economy. So let's say that happens, right? Let's say the Fed comes and says, hey, you know what? We're doing five cuts this year, not three, right? And let's say the stock market says, awesome, we're having a party based off of that, right? And we're heading into the election. I use this stat all the time, but I think it's, what is it? It's 93% of all stocks are owned by the top 10% of households, right? So my question is that really going to change the voting behavior all that much? Because I believe, in my belief, that most people vote based upon how they're feeling in the moment, right? And even if the stock market's having a party, for a lot of America, it doesn't really matter to them. Just not that relevant to them. And to a certain extent, there may be a growing resentment of those rich bastards who are just getting, basically, policy is rewarding the rich. And man, look at the party they're having right now in the markets. And regular schmoes like me are just hanging on by our fingernails here. So, like, would it actually even really affect the outcome of the election?
I don't think in any marginal way. The only reason, though, that you have to be say possibly is because I think it's going to be such a tight election that anything, that any swaying of voters to one side or the other can affect it. Just a third party candidate, Kennedy or whoever else, can just skew it by just enough in just a couple states that it can change the election. So I guess the answer is I think it can. But it's hard to know in which way, probably until you see in hindsight what happened.
All right. I don't know. The more people I talk to about this year, I just think it's going to be one big giant hairball. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And obviously, that's why we want to have smart people like you coming back on this channel again, often to kind of keep us grounded on what you're
Thank you.
seeing in real time. Okay, well, look, let's get to the main event here, which is inflation. So as I said in the intro, the recent inflation data that came out for January was a surprise to analysts who were expecting it to be a bit lower. We've had a lot of discussion about how kind of the 80-20 rule, right? Getting CPI down from 9 to 3 something, you know, it took a fair amount of work, but presumably that was kind of the easy work. And now to get from 3 something down to 2, which is where the Fed has said it still is that's its target, come hell or high water, that's going to be harder and harder to do. You know, I'm sure the Fed didn't like this most recent number that came out, because it just shows that it's not as close as it wants to be to achieving its mission. How material is this? And use your answer there as a segue into the question of your larger body of work that you've done recently, which is, you know, could we be setting ourselves up for another 1970s, where a lot of people said the Fed would tighten, but then stop its work too early, declare victory too early, and then inflation would resume, forcing the Fed to get back in and having to tighten even more. And that happened a couple of times until Volcker finally got the mandate to just do whatever it took. And it took a lot back then, right? I said, I think the maximum was 20% interest rates. You know, do you see us potentially running into that type of risk again, or is it different this time?
So yeah, we'll start with the recent CPI data and then move back 50 years to the 70s. So see, you first of all, let's just start with the basics. You can't calculate inflation. So it's an impossible number to calculate. And the BLS does a pretty poor job of even trying to estimate what it is. So, and then any economic data on a month-to-month basis is skewed. Retail sales were for January, the bad number we just got. December was a good number. There are so many seasonal adjustments and so many seasonal behavioral patterns that change every year that it's just, you can't base any kind of fact on one number. You need to see trends. Inflation has been trending lower now for quite a while. It popped up a little bit last Tuesday. So let's dive into that. Is inflation really becoming sticky and starting to rise potentially? Are we kind of heading back for the second rise of the roller coaster? In my opinion, absolutely not. One third of the CPI numbers from shelter. Shelter is a combination of rents, primarily rents, and owner's equivalent rents, which is an imputed number by the BLS. These all come off of surveys of rent prices. Now we know by looking at Zillow and Redfin and other rental type, you know, real-time market-oriented data that rent prices are somewhere between slightly up to most likely down. We also know that the BLS puts out a number every 6 months. It's called the New Tenant Rent Index. So that just looks at that new tenants, new lease signings, not people that have already been in a place for a while. Those are down almost 4%. So let's just assume that shelter prices are flat. Well, if we exclude shelter from CPI, the CPI number was about 1.5%. So CPI without shelter is already below the Fed's target. If CPI was at 1.5%, the Fed would be concerned that inflation was too low. The Fed would have cut rates significantly already. So what's going on with shelter? Why is shelter in the CPI equation? It's such a big weight, but why is it so much higher, right? It was up 0.6% for the month. That's 7.2% roughly on an annualized basis when everything else is telling you that rents are basically flat, give or take a little, and probably below zero, but let's just say flat. Well, first of all, you know, the price of anything else, oil, orange juice, they're go to the pump, you look at the price, go to the grocery store, look at the price. That's more or less the price they use. They kind of survey what's going on in the market. But with rents, they're calling people up and saying, what's your rent and how did that change? And your rent only changes once every 12 months. Most rents are for 1 year. So it's only going to change when your lease comes up for renewal. So first of all, it's a lagging number unto itself because 1/12 of the respondents aren't giving you real-time market data. They're telling you what the lease how the lease changed, anywhere up to a year ago. Here's the other flaw. They only call you twice a year. They call you every 6 months, the people that they survey. So let's say I'm on their survey and they called me in, what are we in January? We're in February. So in January, they call me, "Hey, Mike, did your lease change?" I go, "No." February comes and my lease comes up for adjustment and I make a deal with my where I'm renting from, and we say we're going to drop it just $10 a month. Great. Well, the BLS isn't going to call me again for another 5 months to know that my rent price declined or changed, whatever happened. So not only do you have a lag because you're almost looking at a year-over-year number the way they do it, versus everything else that is more or less real time, not real time, but very close to a month or two of current. And then you got this survey problem. Then on top of it, they impute this owner's equivalent rent, which doesn't make any sense because even rent in CPI fell, but owner's equivalent rent popped higher. The two of them tend to stay very close to each other. So bottom line is, I think this CPI number was a fluke. There are other issues to take with it. A lot of insurance and medical costs went up in January. January is when those costs reset. So they were a little higher than expected, but that's kind of more of a one-off type increase in prices. So I think as we're going to see over the next few months, it doesn't mean it's going to be in the next set of data or even a month after that. But the day that we're going to see inflation continuing to trend lower. And just as we saw a pop this month, next month we could see a number not well below, but decently below estimates. And it's just a flaw in the way the BLS calculates data.
Okay. Hey, I just want to interject because folks have made comments frequently in the past that, like, yeah, the BLS data is just garbage and the government always underreports inflation anyways, and it's in its interest to do that. I just want to let folks know, I have had a lot of requests to interview the team at Truflation, which is a relatively new service that's come on to, create what they consider to be a much more accurate sense of the price inflation that real people are experiencing. I'll be interviewing them by the end of this month. So just know that that interview is coming up relatively soon. So sorry for interrupting, Mike. I just wanted folks to know that. But take it from here and clearly, let's get to the question of, so do you see us as not having a 70s style, rise and fall? And if so,
Yeah,
why?
but real quick, if I can go back to Truflation, because I've been
Yeah.
following that over the last month or two, and I've kind of read some of their information on how they do it. They're using real prices that they get from a number of sources. They don't get into hedonics. They don't data smooth. So it's a, it's a, in my opinion, and again, I don't know their calculations. I don't know what they're doing behind the scenes, but it appears to be a better gauge of real-time inflation. Now, as of, I think it was either this morning or yesterday morning, inflation was, according to Truflation, 1.39%. What did I say CPI excluding shelter was? It's actually 1.4%. So it turns out that the BLS number and Truflation are potentially very much in line if you just strip out the shelter nonsense. So now the question is, and there was this pretty bad graph from Apollo going around that showed that the inflation of the last 10 years and the inflation from the late 1960s through early 1980s are on almost the identical path. And that one graph, one stupid graph, prompted me to write four long articles on the 70s and today and why they're different. If you've seen the graph, first of all, it's a very flawed graph. It starts in 1968, I believe, and it charts inflation through 1982 or 83. And it compares it to the current time frame, but the current time frame on their graph starts in 2014. Our inflationary impulse didn't really kick off till 2020, 2021. So there's they don't line up that well. And if you also notice that the y-axis for 1970s inflation is on a different axis than the current. So when you kind of readjust the graphs, there you go. And when you readjust the graphs, they don't really look nearly like they do. And in my article, I actually kind of recreate their graph to show what it would really look like if you keep them on the same y-axis and you set the dates appropriately. But let's just go back to the 70s for a little bit. The 70s inflation, and we'll call it 70s, but it's really later 60s through early 80s, was self-inflicted wounds one after another. The Fed, the government, and then a couple exogenous events. So back in the 70s and late 60s, remember, you're not that far removed from the Great Depression. So back in that time, unemployment was evil. No one wanted unemployment, and they were willing to sacrifice higher inflation for low unemployment. So the Fed really focused on unemployment and didn't think about inflation. They were fine with inflation going up. But what they didn't factor in is that consumers and corporations would change their behaviors. They didn't think this could happen, that a consumer would say, well, the price of a refrigerator is going to be $1,000 next month, but it's only 900 this month. I'm going to buy it today instead of tomorrow. So you create some artificial demand. You pull purchases forward, which kind of fueled inflation. Those price wage spirals, which they also didn't really think would happen, that consumers would see inflation, they'd ask their boss for more money, and the boss would give them more money, then the boss would raise the prices on goods, and you kind of get this circular effect. And unions were much stronger back then. They were 20% of employees were in a union. Today, it's less than 10%. So the unions had, more members, but also they were stronger. And so they could push some of these wage pressures through into inflation. President Nixon tried to, put a cap on price changes. So what happened? Companies stopped producing. They're like, I can't do this profitably anymore. So they artificially cut supply because they weren't allowed to raise their prices. Nixon took us off the gold standard. That allowed the Fed to do whatever they want. That allowed the government to run any kind of deficit without any kind of checks and balances. That's a big deal. That happened in 1971. You had the oil embargo, oil shocks. Well, today we basically we're 100% of our oil can come from the United States. It doesn't, but it can. Back then it was less than 50%. So we're not dependent on the Middle East anymore for oil or for anyone else for that matter. And you had the Federal Reserve never took their foot off the money supply. The money supply increased throughout. It went up and down like a roller coaster, but it never really got below the money supply growth, never got below 5%, even during the high inflationary times. That's insane. And that's because the Fed was solely focused on Fed funds and they didn't truly appreciate that money supply is really what matters. And it was Paul Volcker that said, hey, we're doing this wrong. Money supply matters and we're going to get that under control. And that's ultimately what got inflation to calm down in the very early 80s, late 70s. So fast forward 50 years, we have a pandemic. Well, what do? We shut down production of everything, our transportation lines get crippled, and then we just rain money on people and on the economy. So what do? You artificially boost demand, and at the same time you kill supply. That's economics 101. Anyone, first day of economics, that's what they teach you, that increased demand, less supply is higher prices. That's what happened. So what's happening now? Supply lines are largely fixed. There's still shortages. They still can't make enough chips for cars. But by and large, if you want to buy something, it's available. You can get it. You don't have to wait 6 months for something. Transportation is working just fine. And, so the whole supply line is 99% healed. There's still stimulus flowing through the economy, some behavioral changes because of COVID and the way people are spending money and reacting and had saved money, but that's largely coming to an end too. So, when I kind of think about our current bout of inflation, I think it was caused by one thing, by COVID and the reaction. And it was global. It wasn't just a United States thing. This happened around the world, which just made it that much worse. So I don't think that inflation is coming back. I see that the trends of the prior 30 years, where you had slower economic growth, weakening productivity growth, weakening demographics, are all and just too much debt, a debt burden that weighs on the economy, is going to slowly re-influence itself and push all those trends lower. And with it, inflation will follow, will go back towards deflation, disinflationary, to the point where the Fed's worried that inflation's only 1% or 0.5%, and we got to do something. We got to boost it up. We got to be at 2%. And so, again, the 70s was a bunch of events, mainly self-inflicted by the government, by the Federal Reserve. And this is also to some degree self-inflicted. The COVID's not self-inflicted, but our response was very self-inflicted. But it's over. It was a one-time thing. Not to say we can't have another event, be it a war, be it another virus, be it probably something we can't even think of, aliens landing, who knows what. That can happen, and that can change our inflation outlook. But we think that the trends of the last 30 years are still very much intact, and if anything, strengthened by all the unproductive debt we have produced over the last few years, will only weigh on growth further. So, kind of once we get out of this, what are we now, 4 years into this kind of COVID craziness as far as economics goes, those trends, those longer term trends, will keep reasserting themselves stronger and stronger, bringing inflation lower.
So let me ask you a related question on that. So first off, thank you for that very detailed answer and, clarifying that from your perspective, at least as you're looking, I'm going to say for the next year or so, you expect disinflation to continue being the trend. We've got very smart people like the Lacey Hunts of the world, right, who are saying, look, deflation was always the much bigger dragon. And yeah, we had to maybe stop fighting it for a minute to deal with this inflation dragon that showed up because he was creating too much carnage in the short term. But when you look at the real term battles we're going to be facing, it's the bigger his bigger deflationary brother that we have to really be focused on. Then there are all the lag effects that you and I have talked about, right? Which should at some point manifest themselves in slowing economic growth, in the relatively here and now over the course of this year and next, right? So the thing that's standing in the way of that has largely been this net rise in liquidity from a lot of different sources, but certainly a big one has been the extraordinary deficit spending that the government has been doling out. So I've asked this question once or twice. I think I even asked it of your partner, Lance Roberts, there. Now that extraordinary deficit spending has kind of become business as usual, right? It's no longer, oh, we have some massive crisis and we're going to do this for a short period of time. It's now just sort of like dialing the deficits up to 11, cranking it up to 11. It's just kind of how we do things now. Obviously, the longer you do that for, you can create inflation, right? Because fiscal stimulus tends to be more inflationary than monetary stimulus because it finds its way directly into the economy. My question is, even if you're worried about that, which it doesn't sound like you are that much in the near term, but don't let me put words in your mouth. Is there a politician today on the scene who would have the political appetite to say, yeah, it's time to dial it back? Are we now stuck with this, with the accelerator
Adam,
fully to the floor now?
why are you asking? You know the answer to this question. There's
I just want to make sure that everybody does, right?
I mean, look, there may be a politician that thinks that, but if they think they're going to get reelected on that kind of platform, they can forget it. The answer is no.
Right.
There
So
is
and just to be super clear, my question is, We cranked it up to 11. We used COVID as the reason for it. And then the reason has morphed into just because it's just what we need to keep it going. So it's never going to come off of 11 willingly.
It'll waver, right? It'll waver based on which politicians and how much of an appetite there is to get the deficit down. But I think, look, the deficit path has been, it's been on the same path now for 30 years. We're spending, our debt to GDP continually rises. And, you know, there was a big jump in the debt to GDP, but it actually came off. And now it's kind of going back onto that more trend growth, which isn't good, but it's not going to the moon anymore. So, you know what, I think this, it is what it is. We can look at Japan though. Their debt to GDP is twice ours, and they have a deflation problem. Deflation, not disinflation, deflation problem. So, you know, the thing you got to think about, and Lacey Hunt says this, that government debt has a negative multiplier. That means it's unproductive debt, that the benefit you get from that debt, there is a benefit initially, the money gets spent, it boosts the economy, ultimately hampers economic activity more than it helps it. So that hampering part from 2021, 22, 23 is, that's in our future. There's more of a headwind from that old debt that's coming down the pike. So can the government continue to just boost fiscal spending more and more? Maybe, but they're not going to be able to do it at 4 or 5% interest rates. They're going to need the Fed to help them out. They're going to need much lower interest rates to keep the Ponzi scheme going.
Just like
in Japan.
Which I was going to say, so you're basically saying we should expect the Japan playbook from here. And I just want to reiterate another conclusion that a number of recent guests have made, which is when you have that playbook, you know, you there's no free lunch, right? You can't get away with it. You have to pay the price somehow. And Japan is paying it to a fair amount of extent in slower economic growth than it would like, right? But the real victim, like the real pressure relief valve here of this, is the currency. The value of the yen has just gotten crushed over the past couple of decades. And don't let me put words in your mouth, but I presume you think same thing with the US dollar from a purchasing power standpoint. Yep, it might still hold up well versus the other fiat currencies, but from a purchasing power standpoint, that's what gets sacrificed with that playbook.
Yeah, but that's been going on for 50 years now, right? Again, that trend is intact. Yes, the purchasing power will get smashed.
Well, here you're saying like, hey, tell me something that's new, but is it that it's sort of asymptotic, which is that the loss of purchasing power accelerates as you pursue the playbook?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, I guess so. Yeah. I'll say yes, but that's the playbook. And you can't, you know, I can't, they say, Mike, you're now the Fed governor. What are you going to do? The answer is you keep rates higher for longer. You put this economy into a recession. You try to flush out the unproductive debt. You let the bad banks go bankrupt. You let the zombie companies go under, and you clean yourself up. That was a mistake Japan made in 1990. They didn't let the banks go under. They didn't clean up the bad debt. They just kept everything in a zombie state. And here they are 30 years later with the same GDP they had in 1990. So are you going to elect me Fed governor if you're in Congress? If I tell you that's my plan, absolutely not.
No, I'm going to vote for you, but
well, you will. I'll get one vote. I'll get one vote, and maybe Lance will vote for me if he's in a good mood that day.
Well, the reason why I really want to just hammer on this is because at the end of the day, we've got regular people watching this channel, right? And so I just want them to be clear about where our experts like you see the puck headed. And if you see it towards a furthering destruction of purchasing power, possibly accelerating over the years, decades, you know, then the question to ask now is, well, what steps can I take today to at least preserve as much of the purchasing power of my wealth as possible? All right. Well, look, there's so many other questions I want to ask you, but we're running out of time here. I did say we'd briefly touch on bonds. So generally interest rates are a function of where inflation expectations are. are headed. And if you think inflation's coming down, then is it correct to assume that you think that inflation, that interest rates will continue to come down, and that you're still, that's still an important part of why you guys are continuing to hold bonds?
Yeah, absolutely. Bonds are primarily a function of inflation and inflation expectations. And again, kind of like I laid out earlier, I think inflation's coming down over the longer run. There are potential things that could happen that could boost it up, right? If we get in a recession and that 2020, 2021 playbook comes out where the Fed prints a ton of money and the government lets it rain money, then yeah, we could have another bout of inflation. But I think the longer term kind of really crappy macro trends are in place, and that will bring inflation lower.
Okay. So over
And
the
with it, interest rates, I'm sorry.
yep. And so do you see bonds continuing to do well this year? I mean, presumably you bought kind of big into them early, last year, early this year. Do you expect that trend to that trade or that positioning to pay off this year?
Yeah, and look, if bonds go nowhere from here, you're still making 4 or 5%. So, but yes, I think bonds will continue lower, and if we do get a recession, they'll go much lower much quicker. But assuming that we kind of stay in this Goldilocks scenario and inflation continues to trickle lower, I think bonds will kind of go lower with it.
Okay. Natural question that I want to ask as a follow-up is, so what are your thoughts on duration and going further out on the yield curve to capture, some of the big gains that you think could be realized if rates really come down? But we're going to save that, folks, for the conference. One last question before we get to your market outlook, and then we'll wrap it up. On the day you and I are talking, the video that launched on Thoughtful Money was one I did with Chris Hamilton of Economica. And he produces a ton of charts, just these fantastic chartists. And one of the things that he spends a lot of time focused on with his charts is demographics in the US. And I'll admit, I didn't realize it was this bad. The birth rate in the US and obviously in a lot of other Western countries has been decreasing quickly. In fact, the number of births in the US has decreased by 20% since 2013, if I'm remembering that correctly. So, very short period of time. I mean, just the 10 years, and we've lopped 20% of our birth rate off. That's like a million births, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, per year. And this is factoring in all births. So citizens, immigrants, illegal immigrants, these are just reported births in hospitals, right? And you compare that with the death projections in this country. And again, these aren't really so much like government massage numbers. These are just the hospitals basically looking at what they're dealing with and reporting it. The crossover point from where we start having, where the population starts shrinking, is only about a decade away. It's around 2035 at current trends. And historically, he's using the lowest, like the most conservative numbers, like the worst birth numbers. And historically, over the past couple of decades, the projections have always still proven too high. So we may hit that number even before then, right? So that has massive implications in a whole bunch of different areas, but certainly in the economy. And not just is the overall population going to start shrinking unless something really major changes, but the big dominant trend is like what we've seen in countries like Japan, again, where the mix of the population is getting increasingly older, right? So the key part of what drives the economy are productive workers in the 25 to 54 age cohort. And on an absolute, on a percentage basis, that number is going down. And I believe even we may be at the point where on an absolute basis, that number is going down.
Right.
So what we've been doing as a country over the past couple of decades has been basically swapping human-driven production with debt. And debt, as you know, pulls tomorrow's prosperity into today, right? So you can only get away with that for so long. So giving you all this backstory to say, putting on your long-term hat here, like what does that mean for things like the bond market when you have a country that just cannot grow its economy further because it's just not growing. It's not only its overall population, but its productive population.
It means if you want to keep everything going, you got to get yields to zero. At a yield of zero, me or you, Adam, could borrow $1 trillion and have no problem paying it back.
Right.
Right? So the answer is the answer that they've been doing. It's lower and lower interest rates. And you may laugh at zero, but Japan's had negative interest rates for the better part of the last, 5 years, maybe even longer than that. That's the answer because we're not getting any growth. Our, like you said, our demographics are deteriorating. Productivity growth in this country, it's still growing, but that rate of growth is deteriorating. So the only way to supplement both of those negatives is with credit growth. And if that credit growth isn't productive, then you're forced, the only way to keep credit growth growing is with lower interest
Just
rates.
to give it no cost. Yeah.
Right. Right. And
But okay.
that's
So to the person who hears this and sort of cavalierly says, oh, well then why worry? Japan's doing it. We'll do it. Right. What would your answer be?
it's it, it comes at the cost of prosperity for the people. And at the end of the day, that's what it is. You're not advancing capitalism anymore. It becomes more and more, I'm not going to say socialist, but a bought system, a
Well,
manipulated
a
system.
state-controlled system, right? Doesn't Japan
Well,
basically own all the bonds in Japan now?
look, I mean, Lance and I talk about all this all the time. Why do we spend so much time talking about the Fed? Because the Fed manages liquidity. They manage interest rates to some degree. The more debt you have, the more you care about liquidity and interest rates. So we become even more controlled by the Fed, by what the Fed wants. And that's a function of the debt rising much quicker than GDP. So, we're moving away from capitalism to what? Socialism, I guess you could call it. But we're moving away from capitalism and all the benefits to the prosperity of the people that come with capitalism. And that's the cost.
All right,
And
so you're
that's a painful cost, especially I think when you go back and look over 30 years, the differences that will occur and have occurred.
so this is definitely starting to sound like one of the rant sessions that Lance and I have every Saturday, and this super important topic. I would love to really dive deeply into it with you, Michael, and I'd love to ask you the question that I ask Lance when we do this, which is, hey, if you were in charge, what reforms would you like to see? But we're going to save that for one of your next appearances on here, where you have time to do the topic real justice. So I got to wrap it up here, but I want to give just a minute for you to share how your portfolio manager there at Real Investment Advice, how are you guys positioned right now for the year you see ahead?
So right now we are long bonds. We have higher duration bonds, and we are pretty much at our model on in equity weights. Regardless of what we think, we have to play what the market is doing right now. And there's seven stocks. Well, now it's down to like five stocks that are driving the market. And there are other opportunities, but we're cautious. We are concerned that the market got over its skis a little bit here, that we're due for a correction at some point. We understand there's going to be a lot of volatility coming. So we have our radar up. We're prepared to, we slightly reduced exposure a couple of days ago. I'm sure we'll do it again in the coming days or weeks. But again, it's listen to the Fed. What's the Fed telling you? And unfortunately, it's become more about the Fed, less about fundamentals and valuations and all the stuff that we were taught in school. So, it's going to be another tricky year, probably a volatile year, especially as we get closer to the election.
Okay. Well, Michael, like I said, for folks that want to hear more from you, we're going to go real deep into bonds, in your bonds outlook and how exactly you're planning to play things at the conference. But again, I'd like to have you back on, within a couple of months here on the public channel as well to dive into a lot more of the what I think are sort of the more meaningful longer term issues. So anyways, Mike, thanks so much for coming on here. For folks that want to follow you and your work, tell them where they can go.
Realinvestmentadvice.com. Everything both Lance and myself do is there. We also write a daily commentary So if you don't like our long articles that put you to sleep, we put out a daily commentary, which you can subscribe for free. It'll go to your email. And it's, three or four short stories with a brief market update that kind of tell you what's going on in the world and help give you our take on whatever matters that day.
Great. And you're on Twitter too, as well, right?
At Michael Leibowitz.
All right, great. And Michael, when I edit this, I'll put up the links to those on the screen so folks know exactly where to go. Folks, I'll put links in the description below the video too if you just want a one-click access to those. Michael, my friend, it's always great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yep. Thank you, Adam.
All right, well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Thoughtful Money. I'm joined as usual by lead partners Mike Preston and John Lodra. John, why don't we start with you? I'm going to guess that you're like-minded with a lot of what Mike Leibowitz had to say there, but what do you think?
Yeah. Hey, Adam, thanks. Great to be with you again. And, we have a lot of similar takes on some things with Michael. Kind of kindred spirits with him in the sense that we and their firm are your two Thoughtful Money's two endorsed financial advisors, as folks that might go to seek the consultation with either one of us would see.
That is true. Sorry to interrupt. Yes, you are the two in the U.S. I just went for Canadians watching. We do have
absolutely
a firm in Canada, Rocklink Investments, that's run by John Wellham. So we do have that third in there. But yes, you're the
right
two big guys in the U.S.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we can't work in the Canadian markets nor can RIA. And we had an opportunity to have some quick pleasantries offline with Michael before we came on here. So hello again, Michael. And we look forward to you resuming the live Q&As, Adam. We really enjoy those and lively debates and discussions we can have amongst us to illuminate for your viewers.
Thank you. And again, for newer viewers that aren't familiar with this, in the past, I've held monthly or quarterly Ask Anything Q&As on this channel with all of those advisory partners that we just listed, the guys at New Harbor here, Mike and Lance from RIA, and then Jonathan's firm from Canada, where for an hour they're here and we're just answering your questions live. It's not for me to prepare a script and guide a discussion. It's just for whatever topics you guys want answers to. And the questions can be extremely personal. They can be really big questions, or they can say, hey, I'm wrestling with this specific investment decision. What do you guys think? So yes,
yeah,
John, we will be picking those back up again soon. And that's been on me. So I will make that happen again soon.
Yeah. So I don't want to repeat everything Michael said. So there are a lot of things that I think we and he align with on some of the takes. There are some areas, of course, we have some different nuanced takes, and I'll try to point out a couple of those things. But big picture, the economic prognostication that we all need to kind of go through to try and make sense of the world, we'll be the first as money managers to admit it's important to try to get a grasp on this. But like valuations, economic cycles are not very good timing indicators. In fact, markets, if you look over history, look at a graph of the S&P 500 and overlay recessions, and there is no forward-looking aspect to markets when it comes to recessions. They peak right before recessions are declared, right? So, but it's important, just like valuations, economic data and cycles are important to set the tone of the offensive plays we might run. So that, when valuations are high and economic cycles are looking pretty tenuous, we're gonna use our hedging tools. We're gonna have some safety belts in place, even if we're still, like our technical indicators might suggest, hey, to be invested decently in equities despite these backdrops. So I don't want to get into too much there, and but certainly we have an eye on the economic cycles. Few areas I just want to quickly touch upon here. One, and Michael touched upon this, is really the standoff that the markets and the Fed have had over the last several months, and so far as what likely short-term interest rate policies might be in the coming year. I'll touch upon that in a second. And then just this idea that interest rates are too high for the environment we're in, right? I want to touch upon that. And then I'll touch upon a little bit of what the data tells us about some of the misconceptions that people oftentimes have as relates to recessions and inflation, deflation, and interest rates. So I'll touch upon those. But let me just, I want to share, we have a YouTube page here at New Harbor where we speak to our clients directly on a weekly basis, and we touch upon some things that we can get into deeper color on than we can here oftentimes with you, Adam. So I just want to share a view of that page, because there's a couple areas that I want to highlight here. Can you see that page here?
Yeah.
So our YouTube channel is fairly new, but it's at New Harbor Financial at YouTube. But a couple of ones that I've done recently, and you can see Mike and I are prominently plastered on this page. We do pretty much alternating weeks. I talked specifically about the interest rate expectations, say this one here, the deconstructing the Goldilocks narrative, and this one here, more recently, resetting the rate expectations. So, you know, folks can maybe look at that if they're interested to kind of get our in-depth take on that. And Mike's done some really interesting ones, like, you know, calling out the S&P 500 milestone last week. But I'm going to stop sharing right now. But, you know, just to put some flavor on how dramatically. So if you go back to the market's bottom last year, October 27th of 2023 was the bottom in the S&P. And I think the bond market even bottomed that day. And the next couple of months, through a few months through the end of the year, next couple of months was rocket higher in stock markets and bond markets. One of the main reasons is that there was a complete sea change in terms of the market's view on Fed rate policy into 2024. And we think the market got way ahead of itself. Just to put it, and the market's now realizing that, just to put some numbers behind that, at the end of December, end of last year, the market was pricing in an 88% probability of a Fed cut by this upcoming March Fed meeting. That probability is now down to 10%. So the market went from 88% likelihood of a Fed cut in the March meeting to 10% now. Pretty abrupt change.
Wow.
And then if you look at where at the end of December, they were pricing in rate cut odds for the May meeting, this coming May, 100% probability the market was pricing in. Now it's about 42%. So there's been a dramatic reassessment by the market, you know, maybe getting more real perhaps, and the Fed has done a decent job talking that back because I think they're deathly afraid of what the market was pricing into their messaging. But that's been a dramatic change. So that's obviously bears watching. That will have ramifications as I think will still play out in markets. Bonds have sold off recently, I think in line with that repricing. Want to speak to the idea that rates are too high. You know, I think a big part of this is setting the anchoring or the recency bias of where rates have been for the last decade or more in the face of these very extreme monetary policies. So I'm going to turn to some great charts. We oftentimes will quote John Hussman and bring some of his work, but he's done some phenomenal work on exactly this topic. So I want to pull up a couple of charts of his, if I could. So this is a chart that basically shows the federal funds rate in dark blue. And you can see for much of the last decade, it was pinned at zero. There was a hiking campaign here that had to get reversed really quickly in the face of COVID. And then, of course, this hiking campaign. So we're you know, target rate is 5.25% to 5.5% right now. Relative to economic, and Michael Leibowitz rightly points out that this should be, and inflation and things like that should be driven by employment, output, inflation, things like that. If you look at a composite of those metrics and the Fed's own Taylor rule, which they frankly had thrown by the wayside, you know, rates are not high compared to the current set of factors that we have. And that's short-term rates. If we look longer term, and this gets into some of the misconceptions, you know, people think recessions automatically mean inflation, you know, turns around, we get price or disinflation or even deflation. When in fact, if you look at every recession going back to the 50s, with the exception of this one, which is the Volcker, you know, coming to the rescue in 87, looking out months from the start of the recession, this looks at 2 years from the start of recession, 24 months, almost in every case, that PCE inflation measure, which is the one that matters, because that's the one the Fed watches and bases their policy on, has been more or less sticky. And in fact, in many times declining. So this idea that recession means declining inflation is probably anchored in this one outlier here in the late 80s and I mean in the late 70s, early 80s. And Michael talked about the differences between now and then. And then this is
sorry to interject, but just going back to that for one sec. So if recession doesn't necessarily mean deflation or sharp disinflation, does it mean stagflation? Does it mean that
inflation
remains high, but economic growth suffers?
It very well could be. And that's where I think some of the themes of the 70s, while I agree that chart that Michael showed was an example of what we call chart crime, you know, kind of overlaying different, you know, there's enough things that could kind of speak to similarities that I think we're not so sanguine about dispelling that idea that inflation will be sticky. You know, I'm not going to hold off on those other charts, but the other charts, the bottom line is that right now where a 10-year treasury bond yield is getting close to where we think is a more viable level. Right now, the 10-year yield is at 4.25 today as we speak. We think certainly in about 4.5 range, maybe a little before then, we'd be looking to add to some of our longer term bond exposure, but we were definitely underweight longer term bonds. We sold in recent strength and they've pulled back and we're glad we did, but there'll be a time to add more longer term bonds. But right now, especially with the resetting of odds of short term interest rates, we think holding shorter term treasuries is still a very good place to be. So I'll pause right there. I'm sure we have plenty more to talk about.
Okay. Well, Mike, why don't I hand the baton over to you? Anything else you want to add to what John said there, you know, regarding the discussion with Mike Leibowitz?
So Michael talks about inflation coming down. His expectation is that there's downward pressure on inflation. We've got to agree with him. It's kind of an anomaly post-COVID. There was $7 trillion thrown into our economy. And, you know, that caused the biggest, I think, rapid spike in inflation that I've seen in my lifetime.
Right. And, sorry to interrupt, but it also had, you know, just massive supply shock. Right. So, you know, it really was two incredibly rare phenomena happening at the exact same time, both of which were very inflationary.
Absolutely. $7 trillion. You know, inflation adjusted, it's more than it cost us to win World War II, more than all that was invested in World War II. And that caused the whole pig through the python thing that you often talk about, Adam. You know, you lock people in their homes and tell them they can't go out and, you know, they spend money on Amazon or you know, whatever. They do online shopping all day. And so that caused a ridiculous amount of inflation. And we saw a blow off top in equities and a blow off top in housing prices. In 2021, you know, I thought the top of the market was seen on January 4th, 2022, but the market has had different ideas. After declining 20% in 2023, here we are again with another blow off top. And as we speak, the S&P is at 5,026. But getting back to inflation, I think Michael is right. There's some problems with macro. He talks about I think he said that Japan and Germany and the United Kingdom are already in inflation based on some readings this morning. You wouldn't know it by looking at the stock charts because the stock charts look very good. And that's another lesson that the stock market doesn't always equal economic data. And in fact, oftentimes when recession is confirmed, the market has already bottomed. And based on the charts of Japan, for instance, which we have a position in, it looks like it might be the case there. But inflation went to 9%. And everyone thought, oh my God, inflation is here. You know, the cat's out of the bag. I've got to buy inflation bonds. And there was kind of a small window there where you could buy I bonds at 9.5%. I know that you were talking about that, Adam. And that was good advice because you had 6 months to get a really high interest rate. And the next 6 months went down to 6 and change. Now they're back to 3 and change, something like that. So that opportunity is over. And the question is now what? You know, we talk to clients about their I bonds and they ask us if they should be buying TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And if you look at that market, it's showing like a 2 and change inflation expectation over the next 5, 10, and 30 years. So if you think inflation is going to be higher than, let's say, 2.4%, which is roughly where it is now, maybe 2.2% is the expectation, you'd want to buy inflation bonds. But honestly, I think that we might see deflation. I think we see an asset price drop. I think the Fed loses control. I think we see a recession slash depression and a stock market crash. I believe that's going to be the case. I think that we're going to run out of gas with the money printing. And some of the data that Michael just talked about there supports that. So if you think we're going to flirt with deflation or a big drop in the market, you don't really want to buy inflation bonds. You want to buy regular bonds. And so we completely agree with Michael about being long bonds. John just talked about the fact that the 10-year note is at around 4.2, I think, right now. We would be layering into 10-year bonds or 20-year bonds between 4.2 and 4.5 on the 10-year. That's what a normal retracement looks like to us on the charts from the high of 5% down to 3.8. In fact, I could share the chart. I don't think I will at the moment. I don't think it's worth the time, but the 10-year yield is 4.2. So we'd be adding to our position. And frankly, I think the 10-year yield will go to 3% or below. And so this whole game of chicken that the market has had with the Fed has won over and over and over again. I have to say that right now. They've won. They've got their way. They look like they're geniuses. But I think they'll probably lose control at some point. They'll start dropping rates when asset prices drop. I have no idea when that's going to happen, because right now it looks like this market wants to go on another spike higher, another blow off. Nobody knows where it's going to end. But I think we're probably within months of seeing it end. And then I think that long bonds will go up in price and yields will go back down.
Okay. I got a lot of follow-up questions to all that. One, just to clarify for folks here, Mike, a lot of the folks that I talk to, experts I talk to on this channel, who sort of see the future trajectory that you've lined out there, will say, yes, the market's got way ahead of itself, and economically, you know, lag effects, et cetera, may come in here and make for a rockier second half of 2024, right? But almost every one of those people believes that at some point, when the pain gets big enough, that the central planners are going to step back in with another massive amount of stimulus and juice everything back up again. Do you feel similarly, or do you have a different outlook than that?
Absolutely. I know they will. They've proven that that's the only thing that they will do. It's amazing. They've kind of created this monster of a system that's disconnected from reality. Can you imagine if they started cutting rates right now with the S&P sitting at 5026? You know, I mean, they really are kind of stuck in a corner, you know, and no, I've got no doubt. And so they have a lot of ammo now to drop rates. And John showed a chart earlier where rates were dropped. And then, of course, there was the whole Powell pivot and he reversed. But there's a lot of ammo and they're going to drop. But I honestly believe that this time it's going to be a surprise. I think they're going to drop rates and the market's going to crash anyway, or they could happen at the same time. I can't prove that until it happens, but that will be a scary time.
Yeah, well, and that's sort of what history shows. And while we're talking here, I'll try to see if I can't pull up the chart I've shared many times before that maps recessions to the federal funds rate. And you see the Fed hikes and then it says, okay, I think we're done. It hangs out for a little bit. And then it realizes, oh my gosh, we went way too high for too long. And then it's chasing the economy and the markets downwards, right? That's when the economy goes into recession. And that's when the stock market generally takes a big correction. Mm-hmm. And the Fed is just desperately cutting, chasing it all the way down. So if you're right, you've got history on your side. All right. So maybe, John, I'll come to you with this question, but it builds off of what Mike was talking about. So again, as I mentioned to Mike Leibowitz, folks watching this channel are just regular investors trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen and how do they not get caught unawares by what's going on. So Mike just mentioned that the S&P is now firmly above 5,000, right? 5026, I think you said, Mike. So are you guys, do you see this as a time to still dance while the music's playing? I hate to use that comment because it had such disastrous effect for Chuck Prince, you know, who uttered it, but keeping an eye to the door, or is this the time to say, look, we're in a blow off top. Yeah, it could go higher from here. Who knows how much higher, but this is the time to take gains if you got them and batten down the hatches for the inevitable correction when the market, you know, hits its unsustainable zenith and cools off.
Yeah, a great question. And the way I would maybe politely rephrase that is to recast it as it doesn't need to be a binary choice, right? You can kind of have it both ways, not with perfect participation. And that speaks to part of our key toolkit, and that is using hedging tools, right? So if one is just either all in or out of the market, they've got to make a bet. They got to bet that it's going the way they hope it will go. And if it doesn't, well, guess what? Too bad, right?
You bet on red and it came up black. Yeah,
exactly. What our hedging tools, to keep it real simple, allows us to put safety nets or guardrails so that the cost of being wrong is contained, and it can be contained with very known and specified limits. And there's probably no better way to illustrate that than actually pull up a chart of the S&P and give you a little bit of a chronology over the last handful of months, what we've done with some of our hedging tools. So let me just do that while we're here together. So hopefully you can see this chart. Okay, this is a daily chart of the S&P 500. This is the October 27th low from last year. And here we are today. You know, we had a pullback here recently with the hotter than expected inflation report, and we've pretty much closed that gap entirely. But you'll see some dotted lines here. Basically, from end of July to October last year, we had a very weak spot in the market, and we had equity exposure during that time frame, but we had some hedges. So for example, we had a put option on the S&P 500 right here at about 4,500. That's this dotted line here. That basically took the sting out of much of this decline in the S&P 500. And then of course we bottomed here almost, you know, on a dime with that change in interest rate outlook I spoke of earlier. And in this strength, we saw some technical signals get triggered that made us less worried about downside. So on October 3rd, which is right here, I think, we basically took profits in these puts and punched them down to 4,100, the equivalent of 4,100. And in so doing, we booked some gains on those hedges. But we still kept some disaster insurance in place down here at this swing low. Now, further follow through to the upside, we added equity on some of these breakouts, and just more. And in so doing, we actually moved these put options back up here to 4,500 again. Think about the safety net, kind of almost like a trailing stop, right? As a way to kind of make sure the fall, if it were to happen, wouldn't be too damaging or too far. And then just in the last couple of days, frankly, in fact, the day before this sell-off here, we moved these put options up here to 4,700. So right now on about 15% of our client portfolio, we have put options struck at about the equivalent of 4,700. And that covers about a little over a third, almost a half of the equity exposure we have. The other equity holdings we have are largely hedged with some near or even in the money call options, okay? So we're well protected right now, even though we're pretty decently. We're still underweight equities because they're still getting over 5% for very safe liquid T-bills. But the point is when the market is telling us what it's telling us, you can play that for that move, because we are at the end of the day looking to make forward progress in our client accounts. But the key is without taking too much risk. And that's where the hedging comes in, and we can say with a straight face and with confidence that, hey, if things got really bad, really suddenly, they couldn't get any worse than this for that piece that we've got hedged.
Great. And, you know, we talk a lot on this channel about the importance of risk management. And as I've said many, many times with you guys on this program in the past, you guys are real masters at it. And I appreciate you showing folks how you're using it there in real time right now. And I just want to make sure folks realize that using the strategy like the guys at New Harbor are using, the higher the run-up in stocks get, as John just showed, they can continue to keep raising their download protection threshold. So again, if it ever does get triggered, yeah, they're going to lose a little, or they're going to lose something in the market correction, but they're going to be able to retain much more of the portfolio than had they been not using these risk management metrics or measures like they are. And if they have the ability to keep raising them, they get to keep sort of more and more of the current gains, however high this thing ends up going. All right. Well, we're going to start winding it up here, guys. Mike, I'll let you kind of have the last observation here. Again, I just want to reiterate the practical nature of having you guys here on the program, which is really to serve as a model for folks for how a good professional financial advisor who understands all the macro issues that we talk about on this channel, how you guys are making decisions often in real time about, you know, managing client capital. And as I talk a lot about, you know, I think most people should be working with a professional financial advisor because most people don't have the bandwidth or the expertise or the desire to do all this stuff on their own. So I appreciate the role you're playing here, but you guys talk to people day in, day out, not just your clients, but a lot of viewers of this channel who are filling out our form and going over and having all those free consultations with you. What are you seeing right now in the mindset of the average investor? Are folks getting worried about how stretched the market's getting? Is it the opposite? Are they beginning to feel the pull of FOMO? Like what are you seeing emotionally right now? And what's the most common counsel you're offering to folks?
Surprisingly, we're not seeing a lot of FOMO yet. I'm not seeing it anyway. What I am seeing is kind of an acceptance that this isn't real. A lot of people are just, and particularly our clients and the people that we talk to through connection, with you that aren't our clients, but just want to talk. Most of them are not heavily in this market. So I don't really know what to make of it. A couple of years ago, people were in the market and they were like, I think it can keep going, you know, because of the COVID stimulus and everything. And I was thinking, well, that's a dangerous game. And it was, because we had that pullback in 23, but now it's almost like it's been going on so long.
Right. 22. That, yes.
You know, they're just, you know, they've almost accepted. They said the heck with it. But what they are frustrated about is the housing market. I'll tell you, I've had a lot of conversations. People are like, what the heck? You know, mortgages are up at 7 or 8% and they can't buy a house. A number of people are locked out for one reason or another. They may have sold a house and rented in anticipation of getting in. But I was talking to one person yesterday and they said, I was going to have a house built and it was at the beginning of COVID and it was going to, I think the price was $650 to build it. No, I'm sorry, it was $450. But now the price is $700 just a couple of years later. And so now it's like, wow, it's, you know, we're going to have to see a collapse in construction prices, you know, to get prices down. And this particular person, this example, he said that the general contractor wanted like 35 or 40% of the project just to oversee it. So the labor costs are through the roof. People are paying it. Yes, I know that people are flush with cash and you know, people are leaving California and they're going to Tennessee and Florida and they're buying sight unseen, but I don't think this is going to go on forever. That's the frustration that I'm seeing. Maybe like 10 conversations like that in the last month. People are frustrated about housing. I don't think housing will crack until the stock market crashes or cracks at least. And so that's the tedious thing for folks. And for the most part, we tell them to be cautious and wait. If they're selling a house in a bubble, well, then I'd say go buy a house in a bubble. Don't time that. Probably not worth it. But if they're already out and they've been out for a couple of years and they're renting, just try to keep them patient. But there's a lot of frustration related to that right now.
I can understand. And I am. I was just talking with one of the guests that many viewers on this channel know. And this person was saying that they were putting their house up on the market right now. And they were, given the market dynamics, they were listing it for twice what they bought it for, I think 3 years ago, which shows you how frustrated the average person is, right? Who are just like, God, these prices just continue to get more and more insane, right? One of the questions I ask a lot is, and I think I asked a variation of it to Mike Leibowitz, is can the Fed ride to the rescue in time to save corporate America from the maturity wall? And I think that I've not heard somebody definitively answer that yes. I think most people have a pretty healthy skepticism of it, that even if, like I said earlier, you know, even if the Fed brings the discount rate down to 4.5, that's still way more than what these companies are paying on their existing debt that's on their books, right? I think a lot of homeowners are crossing their fingers and just saying, I just have to hang out until the Fed, you know, brings rates down again and mortgages get back to where they were back in 2019. When you and I could have had a pretty lengthy discussion about how the housing market was overvalued back then, but now it looks quaint compared to today's numbers. But I will put it out there and say, I have a really hard time seeing how the Fed can ride to the rescue, the housing market's rescue in time, given the corrosive effect that high mortgage rates have right now, combined with today's prices, which are, as you said, Mike, are the most unaffordable they've been in history, but they're just out of reach of such a huge percentage of first-time buyers. Yes, there are people out there with deep pockets and can make all cash offers and whatnot, but that is, I think it is a dwindling percentage of the populace, right? And of course, this is a much more nuanced discussion. There's a lot more of institutional money getting in there, whatever, that's continuing to contribute to this mess, and who knows if that's going to get cleaned up or not. But at some point, you know, housing's a function of what local incomes can afford, and just more and more, they're just completely unattainable. I just pulled a stat recently that it says that in 99% of America, the average house price is unaffordable to the average home buyer. Right. That's in, you know, everywhere but 1%. Right. So anyways, John, I'll let you kind of back clean up here in case you want to add anything to what Mike said. But again, any parting counsel for the average person who's wrestling with this current market environment?
Well, always bring it back to your own situation. You know, bring it back to what you need to retire and live comfortably. I'll say it again. We say it all the time. Our clients don't retire for 1 year. Don't, or 3 months. Don't make rash decisions upon, you know, short-term moves in the market. Take a really big step back. You know, we're cognizant and we're very much preaching caution still, even though we're invested with belt and suspenders, because we are in the kind of environments that historically have led to significant drawdowns that can absolutely devastate a firm financial footing. The bigger sin is not missing out on some late stage speculative rally. It's in undoing and or unwittingly undoing a really solid financial footing that no doubt for our clients is the result of sacrifice, you know, prudence and discipline. And, you know, that's our primary job, to help them keep that in focus and make sure they can, live as securely as they possibly can for years to come.
All right. Well, very well said, John. I think you guys did a really good job of the wisdom of why most folks should lean into the expertise and support of a professional financial advisor like you guys. So folks watching, unless you're super confident about navigating the uncertainty ahead on your own as a DIY investor, highly recommend that you talk to your financial professional advisor about all the issues that we've just talked about here, provided they're good and that they actually take all these issues into account. If you're having trouble finding a good one or would like a second opinion from one who does take all this stuff into account the way we're talking about, maybe even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there, have one of those free consultations. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer. But for all the reasons that Mike Leibowitz and I talked about, and then Mike and John and I here have, don't put yourself at risk at being caught by surprise at what might happen. Make sure you've got a really good portfolio plan in place, ideally for the risk you're taking, with a lot of good risk management, like, you know, some of the strategies that John showed earlier. All right, folks, we're looking at wrapping up. If you enjoyed having Mike Leibowitz on this program, would like to see him come back on again in the near future, please let him know by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And just a reminder that the Thoughtful Money Spring Conference is coming up now in just a month. Again, that's going to be Saturday, March 16th. The faculty for that just keeps getting better and better. If you can't watch live, a reminder that replay videos of the entire event, all the presentations and the live Q&A are going to be sent to everybody within 24 hours afterwards. So even if you can't watch live because you've got real life things to do, don't worry, you're going to get those replay videos. And a reminder too, I think we have it just for another week or two, but we've got that lowest early bird price discount price out there. So if you're thinking about going to the conference, make sure you act soon, lock it in now before it goes away. And if you haven't heard me say this before, if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, you get an additional $50 off that low early bird price discount. And it only costs 15 bucks a month to subscribe to Substack. So you spend 15 bucks to save 50, you can pocket that $35 differential. I'm happy if you want to game the system like that. I want you to get the lowest price. All right, Mike and John, guys, thanks so much for hanging with me for yet another week. Look forward to having you back on next week, given whatever the markets do then, and you can make sense of it for folks. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
So good to be here, Adam. See you soon. See you next week.
Goodbye for now, Adam. Great to be here. Thanks.